So welcome along to the Diabetes Chat tonight. The amazing Roz Gray is here as our guest speaker, and myself and Flipper will be hosting. Well, I'm going to hand over to Flipper because she's going to lead tonight's session, and I'll just bob up every so often and hopefully say the right things tonight. Over to you, Flipper.
Yes. Hi, Roz. How are you?
I'm good, Flipper. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yes, that's very good.
Brilliant. I just panicked, where's my headphones just before we started, but I've got one.
That's good. So I should start with a quick introduction about Roz. And Roz can correct me if I've got anything wrong at the end. So Roz is a great advocate and supporter of the type 1 community. She has participated in and helped organise many events and initiatives, including the T1 Artists and Tag Talk events, as well as working with national charities. Diagnosed as a toddler, Roz has now had type 1 just short of 40 years and seen many changes in how it is managed, both in her own approach and the equipment available. She currently uses a closed loop system, a long way from the one injection a day she started. Roz is a busy mum of a nearly 2-year-old daughter and navigated being pregnant during COVID and lockdown. And you also work. I hadn't put that in, but I will. So welcome, Roz.
Oh, thanks. That's a lovely introduction. I don't know if I'll say I'm a great advocate. I'll just say I am definitely an advocate, and I'll just keep trying my best every opportunity I get. But
I will add the great bit, because you've done a lot of organising and work on things, I know, behind the scenes that often doesn't go recognised how much goes into it. Yeah. So we usually start off with what is called 90-second questions, but never last 90 seconds. No. But they're more short answers, and we might go in more depth later on.
Of course.
So I do love that we still keep it as 90 minutes rather than, could roll on up to 20 minutes questions. But anyway. So even though we know you at this, I'm going to ask you, what's your name and your occupation?
So my name is Roz Gray, and I'm a trainer within the medical field.
Okay. When were you diagnosed, and how old were you?
So I was diagnosed in the early 80s. I know I obviously don't look that old, but I was. And I was just 13 months old when I was diagnosed. My rubbish claim to fame is being the youngest person in the area at the time to have type 1.
Oh my goodness.
Or juvenile diabetes, as it was referred to then.
I now have a supplementary question and going off point. Have you been tested by, Exeter, because you were so young when you were diagnosed?
Yeah. So I did speak to a couple of leads, but apparently I was just a little bit too, I'm a little bit too old to be classed as kind of a neonatal. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it does sound like I was just a very, very young type 1.
Yeah. Oh no, I just asked because I got a friend who I think was just over 1 as well, and they did test him and he wasn't neonatal.
So I think I had a conversation with a couple of people, and I think I think I'm sort of just over the cusp of it, on a few things that happened on the run-up to it and stuff. So but it was the first time I heard a talk actually on it. I was like, I wonder if that's me, but no, just straight old type 1 that completely baffled everybody at the time.
Yeah. Oh dear. So do you finger prick or do you use sensors?
So I use sensors, but I still do finger prick on occasion. I think absolutely love tech and wouldn't be without it. But I think that reassurance sometimes is needed. And obviously listening into the chat we had earlier, even with the best intentions, sometimes tech does go wrong. So I think maybe old habits die hard a little bit, but I'm not quite willing to give up those things completely at the moment. They're still there in my bag wherever I go.
And I think I always sort of say, some people sort of say, oh no, it's really good for me. And I'm like, how often do you check? Oh, I don't check. And I'm like, well, how do you know?
Yeah. So it's not necessarily like always calibrations or anything, but sometimes you just think, particularly maybe if you're nose diving or you're shooting it, I'm just thinking, where am I exactly right now? Yes. So I just like to have that
peace of mind.
Let's stop checking for myself to know before I make that decision. Let me just check exactly where I am before I over bolus or Overeat.
So, next question. When you do finger prick, do you change your lancet every time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 100%. As a trainer, I would definitely be a yes, of course. You mean not everybody else does?
Strange you should say that.
Yes.
The same box of lancets.
No, it's... I'm definitely more frequent than the on my diversity change, but I think again, maybe it will come on to this maybe a little bit. I think for people who've had type 1 as long as me, that question always kind of makes me smile a little bit because of some of the advice we were given back in the day. So maybe we'll come on to that one.
Yes. And do you use insulin pens or a pump?
I use a pump. Okay. Yeah.
And how long have you been using a pump for?
I'm trying to think now. I think it's seven years. So just trying to figure it out in my head. Mm. Yeah, 6.5, 7 years. So, but yeah, almost 7 years.
So you're one of the ones coming up for renewal in the not too distant future.
Yeah, well, I am actually sort of due now because the pump I originally went on was discontinued. I had to choose. So mine was a bit of a strange. I didn't get the full four out of my first pump.
Yes.
But yes, so that is, I think there's lots going on at the moment. So I think it's an interesting time to kind of be shopping around at the moment.
I was just going to say there's so much and so many things changing. It's a smorgasbord of pumps at the moment. Yeah. So what symptoms do you have when you are either hypo or hyper?
So hypo for me, I definitely, one of these things when I was younger, if somebody asked me that question, I would always just answer them with a set of symptoms. But I find now it depends on the type of hypo. If I'm from having a slow decline, I'll have slightly different symptoms to if I'm having a rapid drop.
Yeah.
So the rapid drop usually does feel like, and the only way I can describe it is that I feel like I'm falling through the floor. And symptoms that I've been, so I just got to stop and say, I need to just sit down on the floor just to kind of reassure myself that I'm not going to fall if it's a really, really rapid drop. But generally for me, I do get the shakes, do start to feel a bit tremory. I just feel really faint. It's a very distinct feeling, and then obviously, hopefully, if you don't get to the really low numbers, then obviously you get all the other joys. But yes, usually for me, it's that. For highs, obviously the unquenchable thirst. But usually for me, a bad headache. I'm not somebody who suffers with headaches. So if I start to get a headache, for me, that's a symptom that I'm. It's a sign usually that my blood sugars are starting to shoot up, which has been one of the ones I've had for ages. Obviously, with a hypo, I think, weirdly, I don't always get the hunger straight away, but then once you start treating a hypo and the hunger kicks in, then you have to try your best to stop it, which is why I tend to treat with things like glucose juice and stuff now, because over the years I have falling foul of not stopping.
Yeah, you can't have a hypo treatment that's too nice.
No. And I think, you know, I once upon a time I was using the little Haribo little packs. And I can remember that I couldn't get those, so I bought a grab bag one, and that hypo did not end well. So that was a roller coaster all of a sudden on that one. So I quickly learned that I need to put things in place myself to stop that happening.
That was like the squashes when they came out. I had to stop using those.
yeah, absolutely. I've learned that they have to be packaged in small amounts. So, I mean, I did use glucose tablets for a long time. And funny enough, I didn't eat too many of those. But, not for some reason, I didn't ever fancy eating the whole pack. But, I found that things like, actually since pregnancy, I quite like the glucose juices because they're just convenient, and like, you know, particularly if I'm out and about and working, I think you can just drink that really quickly.
Yeah.
or maybe not even all of it, just part of it, if it's just needed a little bit of a boost.
Yes. And which do you think is worse, being hypo or hyper?
Oh.
And it's a bit of a...
Yeah, now, once upon a time, I would have definitely said hyper, but I think maybe being a little bit aware of a lot of the research and things coming out now, I think the hypo. But, I think in the moment, hyper probably terrifies me more.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm genuinely don't know if I can answer that. I don't like either. I think in the moment, though, hypo is probably more terrifying.
I think I would be the same, because I think hypo, because, well, more frequent in my experience than, because I have to be quite high before I'll feel high.
Yeah. But
I think when you are that high, it's usually because you're ill or something, with me anyway, that you feel so rotten. Do you know, like, it's, oh, I feel really rotten, but it's not as frequent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Yeah. We've already done the next one, because you've already told us what your go-to hypo treatment is.
Sorry.
No, that's not a problem at all. So what is one thing you like about diabetes?
Which always sounds like a really weird question when you first ask it, but I honestly don't think I would have done half the things that I have if I didn't have diabetes. And I can genuinely hand on heart, I think it's made me a lot more independent probably than I would have been. I wouldn't have met half the people. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have spoken at the Royal College of Physicians without it. I certainly wouldn't have been involved in all the things that I have been. I've gotten not just made the diabetes that I have, but genuine friends that I have. So yeah, I think there's actually a lot. And you know, there's all different I wouldn't have my little one if it wasn't for diabetes, actually, because of the kind of series of events that meant that I moved and I lived in a certain place, and you know, so there's all different things that happened because of diabetes. Yeah. So lots to be thankful for, in a strange roundabout way.
Yes, I know, and it does present some opportunities that I sometimes think that the things that I've done, I'm thinking I would never have done that.
No, exactly.
I see that. And what's one thing you don't like about diabetes? Now, here I could make a long list.
I think the feeling sometimes that you might think you finally got it, and then diabetes decides to change. I think you can sometimes, it's the, you know, it's like the, what's it, the, when people say what affects your diabetes, and my response to that is, it's probably easier if I tell you what doesn't.
Yeah. And then struggle to think of that thing.
Yeah. And then something that doesn't affect it, and then it suddenly does. So, and I've often found with my diabetes that if there's a textbook on it, I'm the opposite. So, I think sometimes over the years I've had situations where people have said, oh, you know, that can't be right, because as you've had diabetes for longer, this should happen. And I'm like, yeah, in most cases, but not me. So I think just the unpredictable nature of it at times. I mean, it's you know, I think over the years we've tried to get rid of things, words like control and manage and things like that. I feel like it's like reining in the wild beast at times, but I think trying to make friends with it means having some sort of peace that I'm not going to get it 100% under control all the time. And it's never going to be perfect. But as long as I'm trying my best, I kind of make peace with the odd occasions that it goes a bit haywire.
Yeah, just I always think that. And you know Liz Warren as well. And she always says,
absolutely,
it's hard to dance with the devil on your back. So you can't have it as an enemy. It's just got to be there with you as a partner.
Yeah. I think you know, you can be spinning. You can be spinning lots of plates, and diabetes just like throw another one in there. So I think it's it's just it. I think I've always kind of gone with, I'm trying my best, and if I know in my heart that I've tried my best with it, then there's not much else I can do. So don't get wrong, it's taken me a while to get to that place, but that means that I at least don't feel so resentful when it goes wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? Acknowledging that it'll never be perfect is a big step forward, I always think.
Yes, Yes,
100%. And do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
Oh, so I've kind of got a weird nostalgia about it. I actually quite like it, and I'm probably bizarre. I don't go around. I'm not going around sniffing any vials of insulin, but I don't despise it. It, in a weird roundabout way, makes me conjure up thoughts of my diabetes when I was younger. Because I think that's probably my very early memories of it. Diabetes and doing it myself, I can't say I despise it in the way that I remember being in the GP doc chat once and everybody ranting about how they hated it, and I was like, I actually quite like it. I was basically shouted down, but I was like, well, I'm not wearing it as perfume, I'm just saying it doesn't turn my stomach, so you know, I'm not wearing the old insulin anytime soon. But
it does make me smile though, Roz, when if you are at a peer support event or a gathering or the after party where you may go have a nice time afterwards, and there's people there maybe injecting or whatever, and you smell it then. For me, it does make me smile because it's kind of like, this is ace. This is just people just hanging out, normalizing things, and they're just one of me. Like, they get it. And in them sort of moments, I do love the smell of it because it's like a trait, it's a personality, like a characteristic that is so unique to us guys. Absolutely. And yeah.
But as long as you're not smelling it because somebody's, cannula or anything is leaking, that's the main thing, isn't it?
But, absolutely.
I think, like I said, maybe, you know, if there's a textbook, I'm the opposite. Well, I'm the opposite. I like the smell of insulin and I dislike jelly babies. So.
Oh,
you know, I'm on my own on there, maybe.
Yeah, you're on your own. But there's quite a few
apart
people
from the knitted ones, obviously, of course, Philippa, they're the absolute best.
Well, yeah, obviously. No, but I think on people we've asked, Tom, quite a few people don't mind the smell of insulin. I dislike it. But
I also think, though, it's insulin of the 80s smelled very different to insulin now as well. So I think maybe it's a little bit of a nostalgia thing as well.
Just smells like TCP to me.
It reminds me of hospitals. It's obviously a very medical smell, but
yeah,
I don't know. I have very vivid memories of the 80s insulin that we used to have at the time.
Mm. And final question, if you were on a desert island, what three things would you take with you? And your diabetes kit is already given, you've got that, so you don't have to worry about pumps and sensors or insulin or anything like that.
Oh, and am I guessing I can't say my family?
Yeah. I think that might be a bit much.
Okay, so I'll. Oh, now this is when you should have given me a heads up on for that. I'd have to say music. I would need some music of some description, and for any other poor soul who was there with me would suffer with my singing. So definitely music. That's. I'm not saying I've got a good Welsh voice, but I've got a Welsh voice, so I'm going to be singing. Do you know what? You really are putting me on the spot, Philippa. I don't know, probably me, a desert island, based on my skin colour and hair colour, probably factor 50.
Yeah.
I'm on desert island. That's not going to end well for me, but it's a hot one. Music, this is going well. Music, factor 50. And I'm sorry, I'm really selling myself right now. Do you know what? I can't think. Chocolate hobnobs. Do you know what? Chocolate hobnobs.
Chocolate hobnobs, yeah.
Gluten free, obviously, but in an ideal world, non gluten free for eating them.
Oh, very good. Oh, there you are. Sorry.
That's a random combination. Chocolate hobnobs, factor 50.
But it's weird, people take different tacks on it. I think when I was asked it, I went really basic because I was thinking, oh, it's got to be something, you know, I think I took a book, I can't remember, a couple of things, so really basic things. And then some people are like, oh, well, I'd like a phone so I could Google. And I'm thinking, I picked a book for entertainment.
Oh, sure. I'm cheating there because, I probably have my phone with my diabetes kit on it, so, you know, I'd have that anyway.
You might not get signal there, though.
Yeah, no, I don't know how well that would work, but I'd give it a shot. But yeah, no, the They'd either rescue me instantly with my singing or leave me there, so who knows.
They're right. So I'm going to just hand over to Tom just to go through your diagnosis story a bit. So Tom, over to
Thank you, Philippa. Hey Roz, you all right?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
Nice to catch up with you.
Absolutely. And what a fantastic sort of segment to our chat tonight, guys. Getting to know you a little bit more. So let's talk about your journey with diabetes, where it all started. So you were literally a baby. How old were you again?
13 months old.
13 months old. Wow. So yeah. My first question is, do you have any memories of that time? I'm going to assume that a no. But for let's talk about your parents. Like, what? How were they feeling at that time? Like, what sort of symptoms were you showing? And what is there any specific memories that they've told you over the years that they have of that time? You were 13 months old. Wow.
Yeah, so I don't have any memories of my diagnosis. I have, I think, a memory from being in hospital, either soon after diagnosis or within a few months, because I was hospitalised a few times with hypos, which is probably quite understandable. And that that memory is really bizarre, but it's a nurse being at the side of my cot. And the song Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go was on the radio. And her coming up and sort of coming and just kind of chatting a stroke in my face while adjusting my drip. So that's just a really bizarre memory, but I have that. I do have quite a clear and vivid recollection of that song, the nurse, me kind of being reassured by her being there and her doing something with the drip. And I mean, it's only probably about 5 or 6 seconds, the memory, but that is probably one of my earliest slightly diabetes related memories that I have.
So what symptoms did your parents see? Did they start noticing symptoms and then they checked it out with the GP? What was that time like?
So my mum actually has kept my baby book. So I still have that baby book from the time, which, you know, back in the 80s, I don't know, there's a lot more detail than it is now. So it has everything from when my different teeth came through to when I sat up, when I said first words and all different things like that. But one of the amazing things is that it's got the kind of run up to my diagnosis in there.
Yeah.
And at that time I'd had urine infection. So there's lots of runs of infection, one after another for months and months.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of different treatment. And I'd essentially started walking, and in a period of just over two weeks, I went from walking back to crawling, and then from crawling just to sitting there. Wow. And my mum had taken me back and forth to the doctor, and they were like, oh, it's probably just another ear infection.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they've given me antibiotics and then go back home. But I was getting more and more kind of lethargic, my mum says. And then she said she essentially one day woke up, and my dad had gone to work, and she took me downstairs, and I was just quite limp, and she sat me down and I just slumped over. I couldn't even hold my own body up, and then she said, she looked at my eyes and she said the only way I can describe them is that they've glazed over. So she called the doctor, and there happened to be a doctor doing rounds in the local area who said, as soon as I finish here, I'll come over to the house. And she came to the house and asked my mum, I think, a few questions. And thankfully, this GP, I wish I knew her name, I do not know. And my mum can't remember it, but she must have had some recollection of diabetes. Now, this bit doesn't make much sense compared to most people's diagnosis stories. But apparently, she took my nappy off. And at the time, the way you checked ketones was all urine. So she put a urine test strip on my nappy.
Yeah.
And I'm going to guess that it went very dark very quickly. But they actually weren't sure if I was hypo at the time when I was there, which would seem to be contradictory, but maybe was my pancreas still working a little bit, and I'd been a bit lethargic and not really eating much that day. I think I was actually hypo, which is why I slumped.
Wow.
over and couldn't move. And the doctor, as my mum says, she remembers her saying, I'm going to try something, and basically got a little sachet of powder, which now we now know was glucose powder, opened it and poured it into my mouth. And my mum said within 20 minutes, I was running around the room.
So you were having hypo?
Yeah, so I was having hypo, which is contradictory to most people.
Yeah.
But obviously I'd had some ketones. Extreme ketones, but I did have some ketones or at least high sugar in my urine, maybe rather than ketones. Yeah. It's actually one of the things I'm intrigued to get. I don't know the full diagnosis story, so I'm trying to do an FOI request actually to try and see if I can get my notes from my diagnosis time. But she said to my mum then that she thought I had type 1 diabetes. She's pretty certain of it, but we would need to go down to the hospital to have a blood test. And essentially, within an hour or 2 hours of that, I was diagnosed with having type 1.
So how long did you stay in hospital when you were diagnosed? So this was in the late 70s?
Early 80s. Yeah, so I think I wasn't in hospital that long initially. I was there for, to be honest, my mum said once they put me on insulin, I kind of perked up and was like the little one I was a few weeks before.
Sure.
But obviously, one thing my mum did say is that, because I always said to her, oh, you know, did they get you to inject on an orange and different things, which was at the time. And my mum said, no, they just showed my mum how to do it. And the first time she injected was me.
Yeah.
Which I just find, you know, the first time she ever did an injection was directly into my leg, which it must have been terrifying when you're injecting your 13 months old for the first time.
Absolutely.
And I've always asked her, you know, I said, I can't imagine what it's like. And she said to a certain extent, she had no choice. She just had to get on with it. I'm saying my dad, you know, they had no option.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of, they felt that they were to blame, that they could have done something, that, you know, because there wasn't really type 1 in the family, they didn't really understand, or not sort of, I'm not my mum's side family, there was my dad's side, but nobody had obviously had a little one that young with it.
No.
And so there wasn't really peer support or support for the parents around either, so they were very much
on their own
with this. Yeah.
And that must have been so scary, so frightening to be in that position. Really, really challenging for them.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were obviously diagnosed, what treatments were you on then to administer insulin, and what technology what was there for you at that time in them early in the 80s for you to monitor your levels? What did your parents have to do? Please tell us.
So,
it's interesting.
Yeah, so it was disposable syringes then, so the lovely orange top syringes that few people will remember, and you had to manually mix cloudy and clear insulin, as it was then, so long acting and short acting insulin, and you manually mixed it yourself, so you had to draw one up before the other, and you'd have to draw up a certain amount of one and then a certain amount of the other and make sure that you didn't get air bubbles in either. So it was a really long-winded process. And because of how the bottles were sealed, they were quite tough to get in. So if you imagine that you'd put the needle into one bottle, drawn up some insulin, taken out of that one, put the needle into the next one to draw up, by the time it's got to your skin, it's already gone into something twice. So that needle started to blunt.
Yes.
And you're kind of encouraged to use those injections a few times as well. So I can't imagine what that was like for my parents, because I can remember using those myself and having to really force the needle into the skin, because the skin was just being pushed in and this needle was not going in. And I can remember saying, it's just not going to go in, because that's how blunt it had got. So yeah, I'm very, very glad that wasn't a really long lasting memory, but that was I was on one injection of that mixed insulin for the first five or six years.
Yeah.
Which now is just mad to think, one injection a day. Very grateful I'm still here.
What did that bring then? Did that bring challenges on what you could eat in terms of Definitely. You were very regimented on this is what you have to eat. Yeah. So did you have like that injection in the morning and you had to basically marry that injection so that if you obviously don't eat enough, then you're going to have hypos? Like when did you take that injection and how regimented was your eating and how did that?
So we did it at breakfast. I have memories of, as I was a little bit older, hiding and running away from my parents in the hope that they wouldn't find me. That is quite an early memory, and that's one that I was feeling a little bit uncomfortable with, because I can remember hiding behind the curtains, hoping my parents wouldn't find me, and obviously they could see me because my feet were sticking out. Yeah. My dad's trying to coax me to, because I used to sit down onto the sofa, and they used to do an injection in my thigh at the time, and me just kicking on, absolutely kicking and lashing out because I just didn't want it. And I can actually, if I think about it, my mum's eyes being full of tears while she's doing it. But that's just quite, that is one of the like sad, really sad memories I have. And it's one that I've apologised to my parents over quite a few times, because I can't imagine what that was like, you know, having a little one now and trying to do that. It's just absolutely awful.
Absolutely. I've got a son now, three years old, and I know you've got your daughter, and it's like I can't even imagine trying to do that to Harry now, like at 3 years old.
Yeah.
Just a toddler, such a youngin, it must have been so challenging, and especially in the 80s, 90s, where things aren't as advanced as they are now, you know, it's very challenging, exactly. Very challenging. Mark's just tweeted and said he was told to reuse the syringe four times.
Yeah, we were told to use them until they were blank, until you couldn't use them anymore.
Wow.
Which is just a little bit crazy. My first blood glucose meter took 3.5 minutes, and you know, my parents say, you know, 3.5 minutes when you think you're having a hypo isn't really long time. 3.5 minutes when your little one hasn't got the ability to speak or tell you that they're hypo is just terrifying.
Of course.
You know, so which is why I will say I'm surprised I didn't end up in the hospital a lot more than I did. And obviously there weren't any sensors or anything like that then. So my parents would get up in the middle of the night and have to check my blood sugars most nights or every night, a few times a night. And I know that they used to check me and my toes then to try and give my fingers some rest. So just because obviously so many finger pricks and things like that. So and I actually stepped through that. So I suppose one blessing for them was that I was a really heavy sleeper, so I didn't wake up for those. there's probably seen, I've posted it on Twitter a few times, and I know other people who had diabetes in the 80s as well have shared it. There's a book called Countdown, and essentially it had all the food in sections which were red, amber and green. And it was all portion control then, so you had portions of carbohydrates rather than grams. So, you know, depending on what the food was would depend on where it sat in that book. And you can probably guess where all the sweet, lovely ones were sat. They were all in the red. So you weren't able to have many of those foods, or they were the ones that you should only have on really rare occasions. And you're supposed to have more of the green ones, which would be obviously your carb-free or your... your kind of healthy food options as well. So everything was dictated by that book. And that was how I ate. But obviously because you'd inject one large amount of insulin at the start of the day, I would have to eat whether I liked it or not. So again, I do have memories of being sitting at the dining table saying, I don't want to eat, I'm full, I don't want to eat. And my mum saying, you're going to have to sit there and just be made to sit there until I ate everything. And you know, we all have days where we don't feel like we want to eat, don't want to eat that much or whatever, but unfortunately I have no option. And then the flip side, going to parties and things like that, I'd be like, my mum would be like, choose the one the one sweet thing that you wanted. And I can remember kind of going along the table for ages trying to decide, do I want a party ring or do I want a cupcake? And trying to decide which of the things wanted, because obviously wasn't my parents being cruel, but that was my, you know, they knew that I had had my instinct and that was it, that I was stuck with those decisions. So they were trying to kind of let me have some things, but
and trying to tell a 6-year-old you can only have one party ring is like, wow, you know what I mean? It's a big deal. So if you were high then, what would you have to do to treat any severe highs?
So if I was high, again, I'm so glad that the advice obviously has changed a lot now. So it would be just drinking lots of water, and you were told then to run around, which you're now told don't do that if you're really high, because it doesn't help, you know, particularly, and you can feel quite ill. But it was essentially go and burn it off. So I have recollections of drinking large amounts of water and doing star jumps in the middle of the living room and various things, just trying to get my blood sugars down. Eating like kind of carb, because I might well be hungry, so eating kind of carb free bits, having like little bits of cheese or little bits of ham or things like that. So it was, see, when I think back now, I do think, oh my goodness, I'm just glad I survived. But I just can't imagine what it was like to try and navigate all that, and I'll never be able to thank my parents enough, ever.
Absolutely. Mark says, did you use the Autolab?
Was that the one that shot the injection into your skin, Mark?
That's the finger prick,
like the guillotine.
Like the guillotine.
Yeah, oh yes. Oh, that one, yes. I've erased the name from my from my mind. But yes, that is the thing of nightmares. That's probably the one that cracked me up, because that was deemed the most cutting edge at the time, and I can remember being really, really excited about it until I used it.
Yes.
But I definitely did use that for a very long time.
Brings back nightmares, I can imagine. Not good times. So before we maybe just talk a little bit about pump and technology now, I guess, is there any other sort of technology that you want to highlight that you've used over the years that you want to showcase, I guess? What sort of things have you used up until sort of now, I guess?
Yeah. Over the years, I've used quite a few. I actually trialed a needleless injection back in, I'm trying to think, was that the late 80s? It was either late 80s or early 90s. So a needleless injection, which sounds amazing as a child and sounds amazing as an adult to have a needleless injection, but actually turned out to be the most painful thing I've ever used. So essentially it was quite a large, if you imagine your pens, your injection pens now that you use, it was like a heavier, fatter, bigger version of those. And essentially you would put it up to the skin and it was air pressure, so it would force it through the little holes of the skin. But the problem is that it doesn't go straight in, so that pressure would go in would mean that you would have horrific bruises, absolutely horrific bruises. But also, if for example, if you were bolusing 5 units, you'd have a trickle down your leg. So then you play the guessing game of like, was that a unit, half a unit, two units? So blood sugars were really erratic, because then you weren't actually sure how much you'd been given. So I remember trialing it for a little while and then just saying this, because I knew my blood sugars were running a bit higher with that then as well. So between the running high and the bruises, I actually remember saying, give me back the injections, I'd rather have the needles, which is quite a thing to say. But that is quite a vivid memory of mine for trialing that. And in some ways, I'm kind of glad I tried it, because I would have probably always wondered what it was like had I not.
Sure.
Yeah, that's probably quite a vivid one. I'm not sure if not many people remember trialing it, because I think it was only in certain areas. But that was quite a distinct one. I think
first time I've heard of it. It's quite interesting. Philip, have you heard of that one?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I've not actually known anybody who used it before, Ros. I didn't realise you.
Yeah, Yeah, so, and as a child as well. So it's a bit of a, I don't know if they would do it now. Yeah, as a child I used it.
Because it always made me wonder, just when I've sort of read about it and things, is like you're saying, how you would gauge how much had actually gone in.
Yeah.
And if any was, do you know, like you're saying, how much was on the surface, even if it weren't dripping in. If you think the small increments of insulin that make quite a difference.
Mm. Absolutely.
I believe it was actually inspired by the by Star Trek, The Next Generation. Yes. from the, that was something somebody said, that they saw what Gene Roddenberry thought would Dr. Crusher would give injections in, you know, in Star Trek, and they actually made that gun thinking about what they'd seen on that. That was what I heard, but that's possibly an urban myth.
It did make good scientific thinking about it.
Yeah, it did make quite a like a noise as you did it as well, and like it, which in one way was kind of reassuring, but in other ways it was, you used to feel the pressure of it going into your skin, and then also the cold sensation of insulin running down your legs. It's be like, okay, how much do we think that is? And I can remember like my mum having a tissue and trying to put the tissue on my leg for us to try and gauge how much do you think that is. So, you know, because obviously I was then trying to calculate how much less do I now need to eat based on that that's just run down my leg, which is just a crazy, I mean, crazy approach to carb counting before we even knew about carb counting. So, so that's probably one of the more distinct ones up there with our friendly guillotine lancet.
Oh.
That one's definitely one that stuck with me. And then obviously I just think about the massive advances. I felt like, you know, moving to four injections a day and the basal bolus thing was huge. Mm. That for me then meant that was the first time, and actually that wasn't until I was 16 did I have any real flexibility in what I had to eat. So, yes. You know, it was a good 15 years after I was diagnosed before they were like, you don't need to eat the exact amount that you don't need to eat a set amount of carbs every single day, regardless of what you feel. So that was absolutely huge. But it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I had any education for myself and I did any carb counting, which just blows my mind that it was almost 27, 28 years before I got any education myself.
That's just madness, isn't it? That's just crazy.
Yeah.
I was just going to jump in from Mark as well. They were called hyposprays. Those little air things in Star Trek. I'm a Star Trek addict. So, they were called hyposprays, which is quite ironic because we're diabetic and hypos. So.
Yeah, I thought you were meaning the actual device that was used, and then I realised you were talking Star Trek.
Yeah, Star Trek. They were called hyposprays, in there, and they put them like up to the neck, and then they press a button, it made sort of a little whoosh noise, like Mark was saying. They were called hyposprays.
Mm.
And that's very, I just like to say, I didn't do that in my neck.
I always thought when I started carb counting, because I had the old portions of 10 grams, thing, that it was kind of just like going back to that. And when I started carb counting, I always and still do think of things in blocks of 10 because of doing the portions and having like five portions for my main meal and four for breakfast and four for the evening meal and things like that. And I remember a Big Mac was five portions, and so I couldn't have one when I was a kid.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think for me, I know it sounds silly, but the biggest thing was this, and this sounds like a really stupid thing to say now, or probably most people will laugh at this, but I can remember saying to them, what, so I can just have a salad at lunch if I want? Because I had never not eaten a meal with carbohydrates.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah.
Which is a mad thing to say. Up until I was in my late 20s, every single thing I had eaten had to have carbohydrates in it.
Yep.
So... thought of actually choosing a salad was crazy, and I can remember being very excited about, I haven't given any insulin, because I remember about a fortnight after I completed the carb counting course, my blood sugars were 5.2, which was amazing before a meal, and I fancied the salad. There wasn't really anything, there was like minimal amount in it, and I didn't bolus. and my blood sugars were fine after, and I didn't go high and I didn't go low. And I just thought, I can remember that, having that moment of like, wow. So for me, that was huge. But actually, the bigger impact of that carb counting course, other than, well, first of all, I hadn't had any education myself, so that was a huge one. And there was this thing, that assumption, that because my parents, that I'd had diabetes for so long, my parents had like worked really well with me to kind of keep my HbA1c as good as they could, so you know, I wasn't really really out of control or anything. So there was just this assumption that I just knew everything, which I didn't, and neither did my parents. We just kind of muddled our way through. So the fact that I had education myself was a big eye-opener. Then I found out, obviously, that I could eat different things and maybe approach my life a bit differently. It was a huge thing. But the massive change from that carb counting course was actually speaking and meeting to other people who had type 1 diabetes. And that was the first time I had ever had any sort of peer support kind of on my own. I think when I'd grown up, we'd been on a couple of trips there was a charity that like local to where I lived that did a couple of trips to the pantomime and things like that for children with diabetes. But other than that, this was the first time on my own I'd kind of had a chat with somebody who had diabetes, and that for me was eye-opening. And somebody just happened to mention something about social media, and I remember coming onto social media and just typing in diabetes, type 1 diabetes, and having a look, and my mind was blown. And I think from that moment I realized I didn't know everything about diabetes that I could know. And I also realized that there's probably a heck of a lot of other people out there who don't know it as well. So that made me want to learn more. My job is education and training. My background is education and training, and I wanted to learn more. And that was basically for about 18 months, 2 years. That's what I did. I went to as many meetups as I could, as many conferences, as many discovery days, as many, yeah, just anything I could get involved in, I went to. I got to meet so many people who I'm still friends with today through those things.
That's brilliant.
And that's when I started to find out about sensors, pumps, and just education. And one of my favorite sayings as a trainer is, you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, there are no silly questions when it comes to learning. You know, it might seem really obvious to somebody, but if you've never heard it, how on earth would you know anything about it? So, and that was really what I found revelation for me, was just recognizing that there was so much out there that I didn't know, that there were so many people out there who also didn't know. And from that kind of I actually then went on to help set up some meetups with other people in the community, because I was recognized that, you know what, it might be good if we all get together and we can share experiences and just help support each other, or just listen to each other, because somebody else might need it as well.
And I think that's it. I always say, any of the meetups, quite often you just pick up, just somebody says something that they do, and it's just a little hint or a little tip or something that they do, and you've never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
And it can make such a difference. Or you just sort of think, oh, that's really sensible. Why have I never thought of that? But I hadn't. But yes.
Yeah. And it is, you know, that people say, I've always done things this way. And I'm thinking, yeah, and that was exactly the same as me. When I went on that carb counting course, I was injecting at the time. And as part of that carb counting course, we were all asked to bring in a meal. And to bring in sandwiches or lunch, whatever it was. We all had our different sandwiches there, and we all had to say how much we thought was in our lunchbox in terms of grams of carbs. And then we all kind of bolused for it, and then we were going to sit around and eat while we did some other parts of the course. So we all got our our lunch boxes out, and we went around and they checked whether we were right or wrong, or, you know, asking us why we thought what was in them was in there. And then once we'd all kind of calculated how much we needed to bolus, we all got our injections out. So we get our injections out and they're all chatting away. And I'm screwing on the needle onto my injection and to take off the little cap off the needle. And I suddenly realised there was four of us on the course and there were two nurses. I suddenly realised I had a sea of faces just looking at me with like an open jaw, like jaw on the floor moment. And I was like, why are you all looking at me like that? And one of the girls who sat next to me, who now is one of my best friends, actually said, why are you using a spear to inject? And when I looked at the needle on my injection and then looked at hers, I was like, oh my goodness. And one of the nurses said to me, why are you still using that? Mm-hmm. And I said, this is the one you gave me.
Yeah.
These are the needles you gave me. And she said, yeah, but that was like 4 or 5 years ago. And I said, right. And I said, have you told me since? And she's like, well, no. And I said, well, then how would I know? And I was actually injecting with 10 mil needles and everybody else was using 4.
You wouldn't know unless they told you, would you?
Yeah, exactly. So again, that made me even more determined to kind of educate myself. And like, please don't get me wrong, but that team are a lovely team. They're not who I'm with now, because I moved and different things, and that team were lovely. But I kind of think that highlighted it to me that just because somebody's had diabetes for a really long time, you can't assume that they know everything. But also sometimes you just need to kind of check in and just say, how are you doing? What are you using now? And I think, like, I've seen that Kate has come a long way since that. I really have. And I know that, you know, there's a lot more kind of two-way conversation things these days. But I think it was a big turning point for me that it almost instilled it in myself that I needed to step up myself to educate me on the different things in diabetes, and that actually it wasn't that I wasn't going to listen to the team anymore, because I really did, but I would go along and say, I've heard about this. Is that something that we can look at? Or I've spoken to somebody about this. Is that something that I could do? I just felt that from that moment, I felt like I had much more of a say in those appointments.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I've got a similar story to you. I did Daphne, and I believe you did a slightly different course.
Yes.
But I think it's the same as you on the needle front. I was the same, went to shorter needles. And if somebody doesn't tell me, how am I supposed to know? Mm-hmm. But I think it's also made me feel that I knew more. So I felt that I could take control of the meetings more. Call it a meeting rather than an appointment, but I'm not saying I take over, but now I definitely write a list of what I want, the subjects I want to cover. You obviously have to limit it.
Absolutely.
But I think it just gives you a bit of confidence as well, doesn't it? And particularly if you know other people have had similar experiences, or, you know, you've learnt more from other people with type 1 as well.
Definitely. And I think with it, all the different kind of life stages, so, you know, going to university, being in a relationship, you know, I mentioned some of this when I did TAD talks, and, you know, the good, the bad and the ugly of it as well. You know, there's been really funny moments in it, but or also how you deal with, I don't know, job interviews, and when you just disclose you've got diabetes, and, you know, it's just absolutely everything, you know, that it's so helpful to have a listening ear of somebody who totally gets it, but also maybe some advice and suggestions. And, you know, and a lot of that doesn't include, you know, I think there used to be a real concern about peer support being all about clinical advice. And I think it's so much wider than that. You know, it's not people necessarily saying this is how much insulin you should have, but actually saying, you know what, that I feel that same way too. Have you ever thought about doing this? Or have you spoken to your team about that? Because I'm sure that you're not the only one who's feeling that. So I just found that the meetups have been really good. And, you know, social media, particularly during COVID, was for me a a real lifeline, especially then when I found out I was pregnant. Being able to reach out to the team, and that reach out to the team was amazing. And I had a really, you know, my team were absolutely amazing as at the remote engagement and different things, as well as the face to face that I had to have because I was pregnant. But being able to message people in this country and beyond and say, gosh, I'm in my second trimester. This is happening. Is this how or everybody else is experiencing, or how are you dealing with nausea? Because I had horrific nausea and trying to deal with that one, you know, and just even having that sounding board was, yeah, I don't think that peer support element is ever acknowledged in the full extent that it can be, because it's in so many different ways it's important.
And I think that's it, like you say, it's like the lived experience of it. There's definitely a difference between what's in the book and the lived experience. It might say it in the book, but that's not what it feels like when you're living it. I mean, I take my hat off to you and any mother with type 1, because I can't believe what you guys achieve. And I'm sure pregnancy is nerve-wracking and everything else without, but adding in type 1 and then being pregnant during the pandemic must have added a whole new level for you. So how was that sort of managed? Because obviously,
yeah,
it must have been quite early on in the pandemic when vaccinations and things weren't necessarily around.
Yeah, so it wasn't really early on, but it's towards the end of 2020. So vaccinations came out, but at that time it was advised that people who were pregnant shouldn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any vaccinations through the pregnancy. And towards the end, there were some conversations about it, but to be honest, I think they were looking at me having a vaccination. I would have been around 36 weeks, and knowing that, to be honest, I wasn't going to get to 39 weeks being pregnant, because they wouldn't recommend that you go full term or anything. I had to make a decision whether to have a vaccination or not, and I didn't. And I actually ended up having my vaccination 3 days after I gave birth. So I remember standing in the queue.
Oh, I hope you didn't have side effects.
Well, no, I didn't, but I had a C-section. So standing, like trying to shuffle into the queue 3 days after a C-section to have my COVID injection. And actually, three people in front of me was a lady who was also on the ward. And we just sort of chuckled at each other, like, this is not what I pictured about 3 days after giving birth, but hey-ho. But yeah, I mean, I think there was just a lot of, you know, for everybody, wasn't it? It was such an unknown, so you've got to be seen a bit more. Obviously, with being pregnant and type 1 and all the different checks and scans and growth scans and blood tests and everything else. But then the amazing bit about, at the time, obviously, because I was on a closed-loop system, as I am now, meant that I didn't have to physically go in to be seen for all of the appointments. So I could do a lot of stuff remotely, could do a lot of stuff over the phone. And that meant that really informed all the discussions of through the pregnancy and for the birth as well. So I managed to kind of use that system through the birth, and I had, you know, the hospital didn't look after my diabetes at all.
Mm-hmm.
So which was amazing. So that meant there was no I'm really grateful I didn't have to go on a drip or do anything like that, so I could just kind of have that that reassurance that I knew exactly what was going on with my diabetes at all parts of that at the time. But yeah, I mean, it was nerve-wracking, and it's the most bizarre way to have, you know, have all those appointments and things. But no, I've got to be honest, I'm so grateful for the support and the care that I had. And so, yeah, but peer support obviously was a big part of that, when you couldn't see even family and friends to have that reassurance. That's, but, you know, there's lots of doorstep conversations, but it's not the same. And it's not how I pictured being pregnant, how it was going to be. So, but yeah, no, very grateful for the care and support I had through that.
Sorry, with the other, like you were saying, you were speaking to other type 1 mums, mm-hmm. was that people you just knew who had babies and been pregnant, or were there certain groups, etc., that you joined?
A bit of both. I mean, like, I knew a few people from some of the like London meetups I've been to, or some of my diabetes come friends who've since had little ones or had little ones before me. I had a couple of people with type 1 who were pregnant at the same time as me, so that was amazing as well.
Yeah.
So that was really kind of great to be able to kind of almost check notes against each other of how we were doing and just check in on each other. But also, yeah, there were the groups, because of like being on a closed loop system, you know, just talking about even silly things like birth plans. And obviously there's lots of, if you look on anything about birth plans, can be about, you know, I want this music playing, or I want the lighting to be like this. But mine was like, right, this is plan A, this is plan B, this is plan C, and you know what the points of handover were, or what target ranges and basal. So I kind of had all those discussions, and those were the important discussions for me, were about the plans with the diabetes and just making sure that both that everybody was happy who was involved in that.
Yeah. Were you at a point, and this is me trying to remember back into the pandemic, were you at a point where your partner could be with you whilst you're in labour, or was it one where they could only come in towards the end? I know I had a friend who their partner could only come in once you're in the later stages.
Yeah, so it was, you were allowed one visitor for 1 hour a day. And you were only allowed to have somebody there for the birth right at the end stage, and for a few hours after, and then they needed to leave.
Oh dear.
And then you revert back to the 1 hour visiting a day then.
And how long were you in hospital after you'd had your baby?
Only 48 hours.
Thank goodness.
I'd been in for 5 or 6 days by that point. So I was very insistent I was going home. But yeah, I think by that point I was very sick. It was also heat wave, so it was 26, 27 degrees while I was in there as well. And I was like, I just need to get off the ward. I am done now. So it's quite funny, on the 2 days running up to the birth, I was already in hospital because I'd been induced. I still managed to do 10,000 steps, just doing laps and laps and laps around the hospital, because I was determined I wasn't going to sit on the ward all day. And people were like, oh my gosh, stop walking. I was like, no, I've got to keep walking, this child is coming out. It was just so warm and stuffy in the ward. So I was just really grateful that I was allowed to at least wander and have a walk outside. And so, yeah, I did. Just amazing that just one of the days is that I managed to get, I think it's like 10,076 steps in, and I was like, that's amazing. So half of them in my slippers, but I did them nonetheless.
Oh no. I mean, when you think back to it, it's sort of hard to still believe, even though we know it happened, that was what was happening. Because also, not having your partner, one of my sort of questions was going to be, how much did your partner know about your closed loop system? So could they have helped you with it if, you know, there came a point where, you know, you needed something doing, but you may not have quite been in the place to do it yourself as you were birthing at the time.
So yeah, they did. I mean, to be honest, like, a lot of the team hadn't seen the system like it, and I was the first person in the area to have a little one while staying on a closed loop system, and being kind of completely in control. And I say it wasn't just me and my half. Lint it all, but essentially the teacher in me had written a bit of a lesson plan and was like, if this happens, do this. If this happens, do this.
Mm-hmm.
I'd printed out my basal rates, so if anything went wrong, I'd had agreements with the hospital that this is the basal rate I'm on, and this is the amount of insulin I need per hour, and different things like that. So I'd kind of printed it all out. And essentially we all had calls just to make sure that I was happy, he was happy, the doctors were happy, the midwives were happy, and everybody was in agreement with everything.
Yeah.
And had those conversations 2 or 3 weeks before birth, so that everybody knew see what plan A was, plan B was, and plan C was. And that made me feel more relaxed, actually, because I thought there wasn't any what-if scenarios. I knew that if plan A didn't work, I knew what plan B was. And if plan B didn't work, I knew what plan C was. But I knew that we'd also tried.
Yeah.
So, the teacher organiser and me was happy that that could be sorted. But
it seems worthwhile because you've got a beautiful little daughter out of it.
Yes, absolutely. Which, she's amazing and she's absolutely gorgeous. But I think it's been quite funny. I was having a conversation actually with somebody who works within the field of diabetes a couple of days ago, just before the weekend. We were talking about, he was asking some questions about, what was it like being pregnant and the impact on diabetes. And I was sort of talked and said, I was kind of prepared for all of those things. I think what has been interesting since having her are the things that it's not that you're not prepared for them, but they're not the things that you when you're in clinic and you're talking about pregnancy, they start talking to you about, the hypos in the first trimester and then the insulin resistance in, second and then the third, my insulin, for me personally, my insulin doubled and, there's a lot of conversation about those things. But now, the conversation is, what do I do when I've bolused for my piece of toast, but my toddler decides that she wants to eat half of it?
Yes.
So I'm like, okay, do I bolus for half and then see if I get to eat the other half and then bolus that bit? So it's those kind of things now, which, having the little one who's on the go all the time, I have done the whole, oh, why are my blood sugars at 10? Oh, that's right, I didn't bolus because I got sidetracked with XYZ. So it's navigating those things in another way now that I...
The unpredictability.
You obviously know that those things are going to come, but I think that's a different, another balancing act for diabetes, I guess.
I'm going to move on just because I appreciate. Are you okay for a little while longer, Rob?
Yeah, of course,
because we've gone over a bit. I did talk at the start about the advocacy and peer support that you've done, and you've mentioned as well setting up meetups and things like that. So with the, I know you've done some advocacy work, like with some of the national charities and organisations. What sort of things have you been involved in? Because I know you've been involved in numerous.
Yeah, I can see the lovely Leslie Jordan is on there on the call here. So I did some bits with Input for a short while. So trying to support them back in the day, because I really found my journey onto pump therapy wasn't straightforward. And I had a bit of a fight and a battle on that one. And so I heard about from another lovely peer support member, I heard about the work that Input did and looked into that and spoke to them, and then was really supported in kind of going back to my team really and asking some questions, because they were looking at nice guidelines, just the first line of it, and there were a few other criteria underneath that meant I actually did qualify. And after a few bit of to and fro in my was accepted onto pump therapy, which was amazing. So as I said, going back to the you don't know, you don't know, I've seen that people did know about Input, so that was where I started doing a bit of work with them. I also, while I was doing the meetups kind of more locally, I also was a lead volunteer for Insulin Pumps Wales at the time then, so that was something that I worked with just to try and widen the knowledge base and information about pump therapy across Wales. And then I've spoken for JDRF and spoken for Diabetes UK on a few things. I've done the TAD Talk artist and helped kind of support part of TAD last year in terms of being more in the background and a bit of the social media and the kind of planning and prep around that.
I think you're playing down your part there, Ross. I know a lot of work went into
doing those things. Yeah, I said artist during COVID, so I was doing that while pregnant as well. So that was keeping myself busy in that one. And then, like more recently, I've done the Taekwondo and Tech conferences, Dice UK, podcast, gone Naga Manchetti Radio, a few things. Yeah, I just if I can help, so, yeah, I will. You know, so
when are you joining the Diabetes Chat co-hosting team?
Don't even joke about it, Roz. I do.
Right, okay, I'll watch what I say. Okay, this is recorded as well, isn't it? Absolutely. Yeah. No, I've done a few things. I was gonna say during the pregnancy I did a few things. I did a bit for like Balance magazine and a bit of articles and then things like that. So yeah, I'm just always keen to kind of support and get involved. I think if I can help one person, then it's been worth it. Yeah. So, you know, if somebody else just feels,
and if you look
back, you know, I'm not on my own, that would be great. That's all I want.
And if you looked back, like you said, when you were diagnosed at like 13 months old, and there wasn't any of this out there, there was like social media didn't exist, there wasn't these support groups like there are now, education wasn't there, like the technology, you know what I mean? Things have just gone so crazy the last couple of years, and it's so amazing that you're just such a fantastic advocate, like going out there and telling your story and helping people. And it's really great. So please keep it up. And
thank you.
Yeah, I don't think you sing your praises enough, to be honest, like the amount of stuff that you've done, especially with Tad and having to deal with all the train strikes and everything. Bless you.
Yeah, the train strike was one that was like, oh, don't you dare. No, do you know how much work has gone into this? But no, I'm happy to not be at the forefront of things. I mean, there's so many amazing people and stories that can be told. And I'm just happy, you know, if
people it's good, but it's good can to hear your story,
stories and speak. You know what I mean? I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Can I ask you one thing? If you had any advice for anybody who would like to be more involved and in some more advocacy sort of things or whatever, what would be your advice to them of, you know, what to do or how to start?
I think reaching out to JDRF and Diabetes UK, I just kind of initially said, is there anything I can do? And I think one of the first speaker things I did was actually as part of a fundraiser. It was literally 2 minutes, I think. They were doing a diabetes fundraiser and they just wanted somebody who had type 1 just to kind of give a short snippet insight into life. And it was literally 2 minutes. And it was the most nerve-wracking thing I've ever done.
Because they both do speakers training, because I know I...
Absolutely. And so I was going to say...
If anybody's interested, you aren't just thrown to the wall.
No, you're definitely not. You have loads of conversations, you have, you know, discussions about what you are and are happy to say and what you're not happy to say. Yeah. There's even resources and, you know, I remember having laminated sheets and things that I could show and share because of the particular one that I went to. And it was the most terrifying, but also the best thing. Straight after it, one of the ladies came up to me and said, my son's just been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. So she said, oh, it's really great to see that you've gone, you know, because I think she said, oh, she was asking things like, have you gone to university? And I was like, yes. She's like, oh, you know, oh, and what do you do? And, you know, talking about my job. And I think I might have said something about me going on holiday or buying a house or whatever it was. And she was just like, oh my goodness, because for her, she was trying to imagine what her 4-year-old son's life was going to be like in 20, 30 years time. And for her, she just felt really reassured. And that for me was massive. I think that was the one person that day that I had maybe given a little bit of hope to. So that for me was great. I was really happy. And I think I just kind of took each thing that I was engaged to do or each event one step at a time. And I think then when I went and spoke to the next one and somebody else said, oh, thanks very much, I've never thought about diabetes like that before, or, you know, so I think just hearing that feedback, I've always welcomed it. And I always know that you can I could speak clearer, or I could have said this or whatever, you know, everybody does all those things. But I think if somebody got something positive out of it, then yeah, definitely was great. So I do think, you know, reach out to those charities and things. And I think from that, other things come out, because there's lots of like group activities or topic specific things that you can be involved in. And so I think, yeah, it's a great place to start, and it's a great place to be supported in that as well.
Yeah, and one thing I just want to drop in this just for the podcast, and I know that it will be on our website and various things so people can listen to it later. We mentioned the charity Input, which is an amazing, well, was an amazing charity, is an amazing charity, that help people access tech, be it pumps, CGM, etc. in the UK, but they're now part of JDRF. Yeah. So if anybody does need advice or anything, drop JDRF a message in their normal messaging, and if it's to do with pumps and CGM, it will get passed on to the right people. And what they don't know isn't worth knowing, is my thoughts on that. Don't know if you agree or not, Ross.
Absolutely.
Their website has some great information on the NICE guidelines, etc. But if you have any questions, or you know, just wonder, you've been told something, you're not quite sure, they are a great place to start. So I'll big up Leslie and her team.
Absolutely. There.
Yes. So, Tom, did you have any questions, as I've monopolised the last?
I love it. No, I think it's been a really fascinating chat. Maybe just to maybe close really is, what sort of advice would you maybe give to anyone out there, whether it be someone who's living with diabetes or a parent or a carer or anyone really, what sort advice would you give them? What's your message, Roz, for people that are listening or whatnot?
Yeah, I think accept that you're not gonna get it perfect all the time. I think it can be so nerve-wracking when you have conversations, you know. I mean, there's amazing healthcare professionals out there and people who support people with diabetes, whatever type of diabetes they've got out there now, but there's also scary headlines and terrifying articles. And I think, you know, try your best is all you can do, whether you're a parent or you're somebody living with diabetes. That is all you can do. Know that there are certain things that will, you know, even after almost 40 years, I have days where I go, I don't even know what happened there. You know, I did everything that I normally would do, but it didn't quite go right. And that could be because, you know, in the background, my body is fighting off some illness, or I don't know, it's too humid, or I'm stressed out because of something that's happened. You know, there's so many factors that we can't control, but I think just trying your best is the key thing. Ask for help if you need it. There, you know, whether that's healthcare professional, reaching out to peer support, and I think just be kind to yourself with it. I think this is unfortunately a condition, as we, you know, as I'm sure many people have said before, it's a full-time job that you don't get paid for and you don't have any annual leave from. So be kind to yourself when those moments when you need to have a breather. And I think, you know, I think sometimes I think, God, you know what, I don't know what went wrong today, but tomorrow's another day and I'll try again. And you know, generally that those days are not every day, so you know, when those things happen. So I think, yeah, be kind to yourself, reach out for help where you need it. It's not always going to be perfect, but actually you can have an amazing happy life with diabetes. And I've definitely gone, as I said, along the lines of trying to make it my friend rather than my enemy, I think. And well, I don't know what life without diabetes is like, because I was so young, I can't remember. So for me, it's a bit me along for the ride, but it's my life at the end of the day, and I'm going to try and live it the best I can.
That's really, I love your thoughts. Your philosophy sounds very similar to mine, which I like. But thank you so much for sharing, Roz, being generous with your time, etc.
No problem at all.
Tonight,
thanks so much for asking me.
Oh, no. And like I said earlier, I know behind the scenes you do a lot more than people know. So thank you as well from us as a community. And it's lovely talking to you.
Oh, lovely to chat to you. And yeah, thank you so much for giving me more time than you originally allocated. As I did mention to you, Philippa, I can talk. So I apologise in advance about going way over.
Oh, I don't know what you mean, because I'm not like that at all, Ros.
No comment. Absolutely no comment.
Brilliant stuff.
Yes.
There we go, Roz. What a lovely, lovely chat that was. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think when you meet some people like in person, and when I met you, Roz, and I listened to you 2 years ago at TAD, and you shared your stories, and you had all the images of your sort of pathway with diabetes, the journey. It was just incredible. And then just hearing tonight all the amazing stuff that you do for the community, it's just awesome, and it's so appreciated. Aww. And it's been lovely having you here tonight, and we'll sign you up to join the team, right?
I was gonna say, I'm just gonna try and get out of this room now with my head. Thank you so much, quick, before
you're trapped.
I found it
a privilege to be asked to do all the various things that I have, and don't take any bit for granted. So do consider it a bit of an honor to do all those
things. Here's a question for you. This obviously isn't the podcast. So how old is your daughter?
She will be 2 in a couple of weeks.
So she's probably still quite young, I guess, in terms of her realizing your sort of superpowers that you inject. You're on the pump.
She's aware.
Is she?
She's far more aware. Yeah. So she, if my pump is out, she says pump, picks it up and puts it back in my pocket. So she knows that I tuck it in my jeans pocket. So she tells me to put it away.
Wow.
And she says, points at it and says, medicine. Oh. So she knows there's medicine in it. And she's got a little doctor's kit, and there's a pager in it, because I don't know, it's a doctor's kit from the 1990s, I think. But she takes the pager out of it and says that's her pump. So she's got pump, and mammy's got pump.
So
we both got one. And she had my mobile phone the other day, and she said numbers, and then tried to swipe her arm.
Oh my god!
So yeah, so she's far more. It was one of those things that actually
they do know.
I was like, I had a little bit of a lump in my throat a little bit, where I was like, oh okay, just and because you're far more aware than I think than I realised.
Yeah,
but I also had the same time looking at her thinking, my gosh, I was 8 months into diagnosis at that age, and I just can't imagine it. So it's an emotional moment, I think, but yeah, kind of special at the same time. That
does she try and get your hypo treatments, or does she realize they're for
mommy? You know what? She actually says mommy's juice, which is the glucose juice bottles. So
she knows.
So she does know what they are.
Yeah.
But she sometimes says cheers, and I'm like, no, you're not having one. They're definitely for me. It's surprising what they pick up.
Absolutely, yeah, my son's exactly the same. He knows the daddy's medicines. Like, I've got my blue little pouch for my insulin pens, or if I'm eating jelly babies. My son doesn't really eat sweets. He likes chocolate, but he doesn't like sweets, but he knows their daddies. And it's really interesting, isn't it?
Absolutely.
They're so young, but they just get it. They understand. And and I want Harry to know about stuff in some ways, you know what I mean? Because it's going to be part of his life, just like your daughter with your life, isn't it?
And there is actually a book that we've got, which is called, I think it's called something like Mammy Beeps, and it's about a mum on an insulin pump, which we've got, which she points at it and points at mine as well. So, you know, there's a couple of things that we we've got, but to be honest, she'd already picked it up even before that we had that book, which, yeah, she's just taking it stride, hopefully, and just accept it as normal. So, yeah.
Just incredible. Yeah, love it, Philippa. Do you? It's just great, isn't it, how kids just pick that up.
I think it always amuses me, and like you saying, your little one knows about your pump and things like that. I remember with my eldest nephew, who's now in his 30s, he used to, even when he was a toddler in his cot, if you went to wake him up in the morning, he'd wake up and then he'd put his contact lenses in, because that's what my sister does first thing. So you'd have this little kid sleepy, then he'd sit up and then he'd just say, eyes, and put his fingers to his eyes, and then he could get up. So they do know more than you give them credit for.
Absolutely.